many cases from now on related to Landor, and those who are interested are very well do worse for them. Look at some of Landor's epigrams. There is, of course, a readily recognizable allusion to a famous passage of Christopher Marlowe in the eighth line. Yet we, had we walked within those topless towers where Helen walked with her boy, had given but us the rest of the men and women of Troy a word and a jest. The topless towers in Marlowe's Dr. Faustus, when Faustus, through his pact with the devil, has got necromantic powers, he calls the dead Helen, the most beautiful woman that ever was, into being, and exclaims about, were those the lips that burst the topless towers of Ilium? She was the woman about whom, so Homer would have it, the entire 10 years of the Trojan War was fought. The three hermits below that first appeared in, you will be wildly astonished perhaps to know, in the Smart Set. American magazine, The Smart Set, for September 1913. Claudine also, to go back to it, first appeared in Poetry Chicago, Poetry Magazine. This is because by this time Pound and Yeats were close. Pound had interested himself, made himself overseas representative for the new magazine Poetry, which in this very year, 1913, had been founded in Chicago by Harriet Monroe, which of course survives to this day. I think it's important to realize at this time on, from this time onwards, that magazine, thanks to Miss Monroe and Ezra Pound, was really the center of the English-speaking poetry world. The early poems of Eliot, of Pound himself, of Yeats, first appeared in this magazine. The first time this put Chicago on the map, as far as literature is concerned. The story is, Pound's association with the magazine is very instructive and also very comical, because he bullied Harriet Monroe mercilessly. He presented the early poems of Eliot or the middle poems of Yeats, and she says, "Oh, my subscribers won't like this. I don't understand it." Whether they understand it or not, I'm telling you, this is it. she had the good sense most of the time, somewhat resentfully, to trust him. Earned herself a fair place in literary history as a result. The three hermits, perhaps particularly interesting, in that it's the second one, the second of the three, when he speaks, explains espouses the doctrine of metempsychosis, the transmigration of souls. We are but given what we have earned when all thoughts and deeds are reckoned. So it's plain to be discerned that the shades of holy men who have failed, being weak of will, pass the door of birth again and are plagued by crowds until they've the passion to escape. On the other, they are thrown into some most fearful shape. And the second mock his moan. They are not changed to anything, having loved God once, but maybe to a poet or a king or a witty lovely lady. While his ramage dragged some hair caught and cracked his flea, the third, giddy with his 100th year, sang unnoticed like a bird. And of course we've already met this in the later Yeats, the notion that it is but the Hindu notion that you pass through one stage of life after another. You die out of this life and then your soul recurs in some other form, either a more beastly form or a more refined one, according as you have spent this life, and you go through cycle upon cycle of lives, therefore, until you have, as it were, earned the right to be let off the endless recurrence of karma, the wheel. Yeats knew this from Hindu thought. Throughout his career, he had considerable interest, in fact, in the Hindu. He became a friend of a famous Hindu holy man, and with him, for instance, this is 20 years later than this, translated one of the basic Hindu scriptures, the Upanishads. But of course, Yeats, in any case, was attracted to the notion of the transmigration of souls, the endless recurrence, from other sources too. And we have seen the use that he made of it in the words upon the window pane and in the play Purgatory, where not quite the same, but the spirit that continues to have some sort of being until it is laid to rest. Again, the question arises, did Yeats really believe this? Was he therefore in any danger of espousing Hinduism as a religion? And the answer is, once again, the same sort of answer I think we have to give to the question of, was he a Rosicrucian? Was he a theosophist? He was and he wasn't. He toyed and played with these ideas and he used them for poems. And they were poetic. But he was never, I think, in any danger of espousing any dogmatic belief at all. He suspended his disbelief in it for the sake of poems, let us say. This poem, and also the one on the other side, Beggar to Beggar Cry, would go, like with the poem that we looked at in the previous collection, The Brown Penny. They do show Yeats nearer than ever before to the folk tale, the folk song, the folk poem, Irish folk, of the sort which, you remember with Lady Gregory, he had gone about collecting from the country people of the west of Ireland. Running to Paradise, page 44, is another of the same sort. Quite plainly, it evokes and is meant to evoke the sort of song to the fiddle that an Irish countryman might make up and sing. This is true not just in its diction but in its deliberately rough metre. And also the fact that it has a refrain. If you remember John Millington sing The Passing of the She, we'll go and drink with a tub of fare and here in something like the beginning of the second verse, for instance, my brother Mourteen is worn out with skelping his big brawling lout. You find Yeats effectively acknowledging that 3 years before John Millington's thing had been right. And he has moved now a long way, remember, from the passing of the she. He has learned from Singh to, in fact, bring into language the harsh and sometimes ugly realities of Irish peasant life. It's no longer a decorative literary idea of the peasant. It is real peasants, if you really find them, or at least really found them and had met them in small country towns and villages. On the other side, the poem, the two little poems, The Witch and The Peacock, are interesting. And The Witch is self-explanatory. The Peacock, what's riches to him that has made a great peacock with the pride of his eye? The wind-beaten stone grey and desolate tree rock would nourish his whim. Live he or die amid wet rocks and heather, his ghost will be gay, adding feather to feather for the pride of his eye. This is, of course, the poem which you see recalled by Ezra Pound in the sheet which I gave you yesterday. This is Pound writing in 1945 in the U.S. Army detention camp in Pisa, Pound's enthusiasm for Mussolini had overreached itself. He had got himself trapped in Italy at a time when the United States came into the war. Yeah, Pound was unable to escape. How far he tried to is not altogether clear. And then he compounded his folly by accepting an invitation to broadcast over Rome Radio Mussolini. Broadcast in English, beamed to the advancing Allied armies. A very foolish thing to do. He wasn't really sane at this time. At the end of the war, he was, and therefore, of course, he was accused of treason. And at the end of the war, the U.S. Army was looking for him. A couple of Italian partisans caught him and handed him over to the nearest U.S. Army commandant. And the great poet was then imprisoned in this special detention disciplinary center outside the Italian city of Pisa, along with rapists and smugglers and mutineers. At the beginning of his career, he was in fact in the open air in a barbed wire cage with the full paraphernalia of machine gun nests on the corners of the stockade. And he continued writing the cantos, that endless poem, which in fact never was ended at his death, which he had first begun publishing in 1916. He had at that point written 70 of the cantos. He wrote a further sequence of them while he was in the prison camp in Pisa. After a while, his conditions did improve a little because his health broke down. He was finally given a pup tent to sleep in the inside the stockade, and a packing case to use for a table. And he there composed the sequence of the cantos, which got themselves called the Pisan Cantos. And among them is Canto 83, as the old poet remembering in a sort of controlled stream of association his early years of his youth in London and in England. And this is a passage where he is remembering Yeats during the period when, several periods in fact, when Yeats and Pound together were down in the country in southern England, Stone Cottage in Sussex, helping each other with their writing. And among other things, you remember collaborating upon the translation of the No Plays. So this is Pound remembering Yeats with affection. The first few lines, the first three lines, evoke what he can in fact see out of the tent. He uses the Japanese term, the kakemono, but really what he's talking about is a mountain that he can see from the tent through the barbed wire in Pisa. There is fatigue deep as the grave. The kakemono grows in flat land out of mist. Sun rises lopsided over the mountain. So that I recall the noise in the chimney, as it were the wind in the chimney. But was in reality Uncle William, downstairs composing, had made a great peacock in the pride of his eye. Had made a great peacock in the... Made a great peacock in the pride of his eye. Pride of his eye, as indeed he had, and perdurable. A great peacock, ah, Epimenius, or as in the advice of the young man to breed and get married or not, as you choose to regard it. Yet Stone Cottage in Sussex by the waste moor, or whatever, and the holly bush, who would not eat ham for dinner because peasants eat ham for dinner despite the excellent quality and the pleasure of having it hot. Well, those days are gone forever. And the travelling rug with the coonskin tabs, and his hearing nearly all Wordsworth for the sake of his conscience about preferring a nemosaur on witches. Did we ever get to the end of Doughty? The dawn in Britain? Perhaps not. Someone's withdrawn, sir. Being aliens in prohibited area, clouds lift their small mountains before the elder hills. Well, that plainly, the poem that Uncle William was composing downstairs was this poem, was it not? The peacock, in the pride of his eye. And of course there are other passages in which Pound's feet are with the same exasperated affection of Yeats, how Yeats composed. Actually, he speaks once of how he, it must have been on this occasion, or on one of these occasions, how he got Yeats to read a lyric of Burns, and Pound exploded with laughter and rolled on the floor. You see, he keened it, you see, long, made a great peacock in the pride of his eye, as indeed he did. The other passages, well, since we are looking at Pound for the moment, may not be so plain. Anybody make anything of the advice to the young man to read and get married, or not, as you choose to regard it? Mr. Sherman? Or Aere Perennius before? What's that mean? And which mean? Right. This is, in fact, his way, therefore, of paying Yeats a great compliment. A great peacock more enduring than bronze, which is also what Shakespeare says in his sonnets. This rhyme shall outlast the gilded monuments of princes. And the sonnet sequence, Shakespeare's sonnets, do appear to be giving advice, anyway, the first of them, giving advice to a young man to breed and get married. So that the reference is to Horace in the first place and to Shakespeare of the sonnets in the second, and Pound is saying that Uncle William will, his poems, including the peacock, will outlast the gilded monuments of princes and will be more lasting than bronze. And so in the middle of the affectionate mockery, he is at the same time saying that nevertheless this was a poet to be named along with Horace and Shakespeare. The next passage, I hope, is plain. This is Yeats's fantastic snobbery. wouldn't eat ham for dinner, because peasants eat ham for dinner, despite, says Pound, the excellent quality of the pleasure of having it hot. Well, those days are gone forever. And he's hearing nearly all Wordsworth for the sake of his conscience. Well, Pound also was a great admirer of Wordsworth, and it must have been a sort of purgatorial exercise for the pair of them to read Wordsworth, who was a poet that both of them, I suppose, respected, but neither of them remotely loved. So they did it for the sake of their conscience. But really what he would prefer was to read a crazy book about witchcraft. Did we ever get to the end of Doughty, the Dawn in Britain? This is a curious, quite serious book by Doughty, who was a British poet of the end of the 19th century, and The Dawn in Britain is, in fact, a long epic poem, which we ought to look at and read more often than we do, in fact. It is, in its way, an experimental poem. And so here again you have Pound and Yeats together reading Doughty's Dawn in Britain to each other. Did we ever get to the end? Dawn in Britain? Perhaps not. Someone's withdrawn, sir, and that is another joke. I've mentioned already that because Yeats the Irishman and Pound the American, both of them aliens, were in fact at this point in that part of Sussex which is near the sea and therefore is in a military zone, they were under suspicion from the police and thought to be flashing signals to U-boats in the channel. And so the police were, did come around, and they had to clear themselves. And that's someone's withdrawn, sir, is the policeman saying, no, you're all right. But of course, it's sort of a joke, because the other accusation or allegation is that we never finished the dawn in Britain. Well, perhaps we didn't. We'll withdraw that summons, too. Remarkable that the old man in that desperate situation, he was already an old man by this time, found not altogether right in the head, afflicted by dysentery, preparing to be flown back to Washington to stand trial for treason, was capable of keeping his spirits up with this sort of affectionate, humorous reminiscence. Go on, page 46, to a child dancing in the wind, and the other poem 2 years later. Yeats didn't know what to do about these poems. One time they were two parts of one poem, in some of the printings, that's how he had it. They're not really, I think, very important poems, except insofar as they are in fact about, and addressed to, a young woman called Isolde Gonne, who was in fact the adopted daughter of Maud Gonne. By this time, Yeats really was quite desperate to get married and to have children. And one of the more, he appears to have yet once again proposed to Maud Gonne, yet once again been rejected, and then in desperation and proposed to the daughter too, who also turned it down. Isolde Gonne, I think, still survives. I'm not sure. She did marry an Irish novelist called Francis Stewart, who was still alive a few years ago. Fallen Majesty, bottom of page 47, is again for Maud Gonne. Very interesting metrically. This is written in Alexandrine. It has 6 feet of the line, which, as I think I've mentioned once before, is rare in English, not really a natural meter in English. Yeats does use it from time to time and uses it with great distinction. Although crowds gathered once, if she but showed her face, and even old men's eyes grew dim, this hand alone, like some last courtier at a gypsy camping place, babbling of fallen majesty, records what's gone. The lineaments, a heart that laughter has made sweet, these remain, but I record what's gone. A crowd will gather and not know it walks the very street whereon a thing once walked that seemed a burning cloud. A magnificent hyperbolical compliment. Maud Gonne by this time, of course, is herself a middle-aged woman and has lost the beauty that she first had, which is what the first lines are about. Says the lineaments, the features remain, and the heart, but I record what's gone, how beautiful she was. A crowd will gather and not know it walks the very street whereon a thing once walked but seemed a burning cloud. Like some last courtier at a gypsy camping place, this increasingly now becomes Yeats's, for the next few years, Yeats's sort of solution to his ambiguous position. I did mention this too. He wants to become the sort of court poet in some artificial court, which doesn't have to be a very splendid or powerful place, need be only the large house in an estate like Maud Gonne's in Coole Park. And he envisages himself in relation to her in the way that a court poet is to his monarch. And this increasingly becomes his way of explaining his otherwise extremely ambiguous social position, hating the middle class from which he in fact derives. Suddenly I saw the cold and rook delighting heaven, the next slide, the next poem, also in this same extraordinary meter. Again, this too is about metempsychosis, the survival after death, the possibility at any rate that the soul has to live its life again in some other fleshly shape. That's in the end of the poem. Suddenly I saw the cold and rook-delighting heaven that seemed as though ice burned and was but the more ice. And thereupon imagination and heart were driven so wild that every casual thought of that and this vanished and left but memories that should be out of season with the hot blood of youth, of love crossed long ago. And I took all the blame out of all sense and reason until I cried and trembled and rocked to and fro, riddled with light. Ah, when the ghost begins to quicken, confusion of the deathbed over, is it sent out naked on the roads, as the books say, and stricken by the injustice of the skies for punishment? T.R. Hayne, in that book, The Lonely Tower, names this as the first poem in Yeats which shows the influence of Donne, the influence of Yeats's reading of Herbert Grierson's edition of Donne, the first scholarly edition that was in several centuries, which did in fact come out in 1912, which was sent by Grierson to Yeats, and which provoked from Yeats some extraordinarily interesting letters. I'll get the crucial one, if I can remember, run off for you and give it to you on Monday. No, not Monday. Yes, Monday. I don't know, sometime next week. If this is true, I think that what Hen had in mind is perhaps the last line. It seemed as though ice burned and was but the more ice, where there is an ingenious comparison, such as indeed one might associate with Donne and the 17th century witty metaphysical poets, though there are to be many more explicit examples of Donne in the next few years. That the night come is also by about Maud Gonne. I pass over these short poems quickly, but this does not mean to say that they're not to be admired and dwelt upon and studied. I have warned you before now that not to think that a short poem is therefore an unimportant one. Some of Yeats's short poems, including some that are as short as merely a two-line epigram, are among his most remarkable achievements. And I tried to iterate again when speaking of the whole tradition of the epigram from the ancient world, from Catullus to Ben Jonson and Landor, as it comes to Yeats, is in fact a very important kind of poem indeed, which requires the greatest skill and which can say the most memorable things very tersely. This, of course, is not quite an epigram, but it is distinctly working in that area of poetry. The wonderful word outrageous, for instance, in the three lines from the end, is really what I think one could say picks the whole poem up and justifies it. She lived in storm and strife. Her soul had such desire for what proud death may bring that it could not endure the common good of life, but lived as 'twere a king that packed his marriage day with banneret and pennon, trumpet and kettle drum and the outrageous cannon. Bundle time away for the night. You'd have great difficulty, I think, defining precisely what the tone is of that. Those references to military celebration of a marriage day. Banneret, pennon, trumpet, kettle drum, and canon, plainly, it's a fairy tale king having a sort of fairy tale existence in a fairy tale world. It's not 20th century, and these words are at once archaic and yet more than a little comical. And this is what gets at an effect of very great complexity, really. And we've seen Yeats using comedy in this way, in for instance, The Width on the Window Pane. And in even a short poem like this, it's serious, it's a serious compliment, but the he's not afraid of comic, of acknowledging the comedy in the situation and the comedy in himself. The Magi. This was a poem that was particularly applauded by Pound in 1914. He said that they chose imagism. The Magi are, of course, the wise men who came to the Christ child being led by a star. But in Yeats's poem, they are apparitions in the sky. Now and at all times, I can see in the mind's eye, in their stiff painted clothes, the pale unsatisfied ones appear and disappear in the blue depths of the sky, with all their ancient faces like rain-beaten stones, and all their helms of silver hovering side by side, and all their eyes still fixed, hoping to find once more, being by Calvary's turbulence unsatisfied, the uncontrollable mystery on the bestial floor. Those last two lines perhaps have a power and resonance that we've never seen earlier. I look forward to some of Yeats's greatest effects, and indeed to some of his profoundest thoughts. He imagines here the wise men looking for another Christ. And he has this extraordinary being by Calvary's turbulence unsatisfied. Let's say, the Christ that was born at Bethlehem and honored by the wise men, this began the 30-year cycle which ended on the hill of Calvary and the crucifixion. In Christian thought, this is, of course, the one certified eruption of the supernatural, the eternal world, into the world of time. The one time when the world of God, eternity, intersects with the world of unrolling time. Hence, in the Christian scheme of things, that 30-year interval is the one space of recorded historical time which makes sense of all the others. All the previous centuries are to be seen as leading up to that. All the subsequent centuries up to the present moment have meaning and are redeemed from mere nonsensical, tedious recurrence only by virtue of that particular span of 30 years when God became man, was born, was crucified. Yeats, here and in other poems, he never was a Christian, remember, but he does not deny that God became man in the figure of Christ, but for him this is something which recurs at a space of several centuries. For him it is not to be supposed, he believes that God became man in Christ and dwelt on earth, but he believes that centuries before, God had become man and had suffered in other civilizations at other times. And of course, others have believed this. Others have believed that, for instance, the figure of Adonis in ancient Egyptian and archaic Greek thought is something the same, the vegetable god who becomes man is in fact torn to pieces by a wild boar in the myth. That, all right, if God came and was man in Jesus Christ, why centuries before could he not have come and been made man in the figure of Adonis, which we know about through ancient mythology. And once we've said that, then we say, and when will the god come again? Yeats increasingly now begins to think that the coming of the new god is imminent, because for him, the Christian dispensation, the nearly 2,000 years of Christendom, is plainly over. He can see no hope except increasing vulgarization, as increasingly mass democracy becomes the inevitable form of 20th century life. It inevitably means, as far as Yeats is concerned, the destruction of just about everything that has made the previous 20 centuries worth anything. Not just of artistic monuments, but also of habits of thought and feeling, valuable custom and ceremony, of harmony and order in the social life as well as in the life of the imagination. All of these things, he is by now sure, are doomed, because mass democracy has come and is irreversible. Hence, increasingly now, he hopes for an end. Let it get worse and worse until it finally break down into total anarchy and chaos, and then let there be a new dispensation. Let the new gods come. Let there be a new eruption, as it were, from the eternal world to start a new historical cycle proceeding. A new historical cycle. He will not live to see it. But it is all that he can hope for. And this is what is meant by those last two lines. Being by Calvary's turbulence unsatisfied, the uncontrollable mystery on the bestial floor. Now this, you may think, is very peculiar language in which to speak of, and of course blasphemous and sacrilegious language, in which to speak of the birth of the Christ child. The conception of the Christ child, indeed, by the Holy Ghost in Mary, and then the birth of it. But Yeats means what he says, and there are going to be more powerful points in which he elaborates this. When there is an interruption of the human by a force from outside, all that the human sensibility and consciousness can record is that something has come from outside. Whether it is superhuman or subhuman, you cannot tell. And in fact, the human consciousness seems to continually confuse the two. Hence, for instance, the elements of bestiality and abandonment, blood sacrifice, and so on, which we do associate with the recorded religions of particularly the Western world, and of which, it has to be faced, prominent vestiges survive into the Christian dispensation. The very matter of the crucifixion, when one thinks of it as an actual event, is, of course, a bestial horror, a tortured death, with all the details that one is told about in the Gospels, the jeering soldiers, the offering of the sponge full of vinegar to the dying being. Thus, when a god arrives, if we can think in these terms, the way Yeats wants us to think, when a god arrives and erupts into our life, he is not going to be the gentle Jesus, meek and mild. He's likely to be a horrifying, grotesque force. At any rate, that is how we are likely to register him. And his birth is likely to be part and parcel of this of the same phenomenon. Hence, the uncontrollable mystery on the bestial floor. Bestial. course, that's the uncontrollable mystery at one point, obviously, is the process of conception. It is the process of sexual generation, which is, in some sense, it's a mystery. It is uncontrollable in the transport of sexual passion, and it is also, in a sense, bestial, since it is what the beasts do too.
Yes. Well, then are you arguing that this doesn't really characterize that force in a negative way? Like, I'm thinking of the Second Coming, and some people read that, I think, as sort of an antichrist. In other words, the description of it and the beast, the bestial imagery is a characterization of the kind of force. You seem to be saying that that's not true.
On the contrary, I'm saying that it is true, and I am saying that Yeats welcomes it. Yeats welcomes the new force that will come. It will be, or at any rate, it will seem to be bestial. That what rough beast its hour come round at last slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. The last line of this poem, The Second Coming, which of course I do have in mind, and which this is looking forward to. About to hit it in about 3 or 4 years' time. 3 or 4 years' time, I mean, in, as we follow Yeats through his life. But certainly, I don't think, we can't say that it's positive or negative, or whether he's in favour of it or against it, hardly. I don't think it's anti-Christian, no. He believes that the divine has erupted into the human at various times over recorded and unrecorded history, that the coming of Christ and his passion and crucifixion was one legitimate example of that. In fact, the last one that we have record. It is time for a new one. It is high time for a new one to stop us being the way we are and start us off on some new kick. When it comes, however, it will be as Christ's own life was. It will be, from many points of view, a bestial horror. I mean, nothing is more horrible than, as I say, that what in fact happened to Jesus Christ at the hands of the mankind he had come to save. And so this is very profound thinking, very profound feeling, I think. And the language in which it is expressed here is has an extraordinary audacity of power, I think. We shall see it taken up, particularly in the Second Coming, and elsewhere. We meet on Monday, but not on Tuesday, because I'm going, I shall be away out of town on Tuesday. We'll meet once more on Monday, and then again on Thursday. And I would like to give some time for a discussion of autobiographies. Not that I have anything prepared, but I would like people to raise questions or draw attention to particular passages. We might very well do that on Monday. Read along with carefully, slowly, and along with certain secondary criticism and commentary. The first book that that will help you is a book that I do have on reserve. I've mentioned it before. George Brandon Thall's Prolegomena. Now, this is not a book, as you will know, those of you who have consulted it, it is not a book to be read through. It is entirely a handbook. Every poem in the collected poems of Yeats is listed here. There's a title index at the back, which enables you to find where the poem is. And then there is, in note form, for the most part, a brief clarification of some of the special allusions. There's a detailed history, which needn't in most cases concern you, of the publishing history of the poem, where it first appeared, when it was reprinted, changes between the first printing and the second, third, and fourth, and so on. That's fascinating stuff, but you won't need that for the most part. And then there is a series of brief cryptic references to the principal commentaries or passages of other books and articles which had appeared over the years up to the publication of Saul, which itself is now 20 years old. I Again, you won't need to follow up all of these, but you will, I think, find it necessary to follow up all of them. By this time, I guess, people who are in this sort of class ought to know how to play your primary text against your secondary.